Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by BlackRifleCoffee.com. Put down the water and grab a fucking drink.
Drink.
Welcome to Drinking Bros. We got a very special guest tonight. A man who only needs one name. Jocko. Yeah. I'm not even going to say his last name. There's no need. There's certain people in this world that you don't even have to say their last name. You just know who they are. Talking about Kobe. Talking about Cher. Okay, maybe not Cher. But Jocko is definitely one of those people. Today, he sits down with Evan Hafer and does a little one-on-one. They also talk about veteran-owned businesses. This initially ran on our sister show, Launch Code, which Evan is a host of. And now we're running it on Drinking Bros. It was one of the greatest episodes we've ever had. And we thought, well, we would share it here with you tonight. But first, we have some sponsors that put this whole shit wagon on the air. First and foremost, talking about BlackRifleCoffee.com. Get a little BRCC in ya, man. If you're like me, trying to come back from this Thanksgiving, it's taking a few more extra cups of coffee here to get the engines going. Fuck me, did I overeat. Great times. Had a blast, but I need some BRCC to get me going now. They got K-Cups. They got bags. Their Black Friday sale was off the fucking chain, too. They had a 40% off. Look, we got a new promo code. DrinkinBros20 at BlackRifleCoffee.com. Use it on the coffee club of the month. Sign up. They're doing deals all the time, but they're sending to you through email. Sign up for the coffee club of the month. Use the promo code DrinkinBros20 and get on it, man. They deliver at the same date of every single month. K-Cups, bags, a bunch of amazing blends. Speaking of which, since we got Mike the Cop and Officer Daniels on today, they've got a thin blue line bag. This is I'm actually getting some from my neighbors for Christmas, man. So super stoked about that. Super stoked about everything that Black Rifle Coffee does. Go to BlackRifleCoffee.com. Type in the promo code DrinkinBros20 for 20% off over there. Next up, we got StrikeForceEnergy.com. Strikeforce Energy is the premier energy drink in the biz. Great stocking stuffer. So look, if you're out there, it's Black Friday or Cyber Monday, whatever the fuck it is. Use the promo code DrinkinBros for 20% off. They got 4 amazing flavors. And they come in little boxes, so it's great for stocking stuffers. They're 10 packs too. Get a 4-pack for them. That way you can get the lemon, orange, grape, and original. They also got a 20-pack and a 750 milliliter bottle. You can kick the can. You don't need the can anymore at StrikeForceEnergy.com. Use the promo code DrinkinBros for 20% off. They also have a subscription in the month club, which is great at StrikeForceEnergy.com. DrinkinBros, 20% off, and they ship everywhere in the entire world. Next up, we got GhostBed.com/DrinkinBros. God damn it. I love the fact that we have our own landing page there. I also love the fact that they're dropping massive deals for the holidays. Their Black Friday deal is extending until Monday, and I believe next week. It is $7.99 off for a bundle package. They're offering $200 off on a bed, $300 off if you get beds and pillows. I mean, the deals there are fucking incredible. Go to GhostBed.com/DrinkinBros right now and get a mattress if you need one. It gets shipped right to your house. Same with the adjustable base, man. No assembly required. You pull it out, boom. A couple hours later, you're ready to go. The other thing I like, they get a pay-as-you-go plan. No interest on it for 36 months, which is insanity. 3 years, no interest. A lot of you, if you're out there like me, you know, you're married, and usually at this point in my life, we go on, you know, go all in on one gift together. If you're looking to get a mattress, this is the way to do it, and this is the best savings for you if you're a man or a woman. Do it. Get a mattress from ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Best decision I've ever made. I love their fucking mattresses. We all do, to be honest with you. Next up, we got bisonunion.com. Be the bison. Bison Union, obviously, is owned by hashtag Bert from TV. Look, man, we wear their products all the time. We love Bison Union. If you're a dude, the shit just fits right. You look cool. They get custom-made boots, belts, hats. Look, we wear their hats all the time on our Instagram. At Matt Best Official or at ST James. If you're doing it right, we all wear Bert's gear. Him and Candace, his wife, they moved to Wyoming. That's why he's not on the show as much anymore, so they could, you know, focus more on the company. Look, it just became huge, man. All of us started wearing it and then loved it. Everybody else started wearing it. They're like, oh shit, this is really as great as you say. And it is. So we got together with them. You guys asked for a promo code. We have one now. It's Drinking Bros. 20% off. Go to Bison Union. Get all of your shit for the holidays that you need for Christmas at bisonunion.com. I can tell you, man, it's worth it. Next up, we got grillyourassoff.com. 100% veteran owned seasonings for the holidays. Seasonings for everything, man. We use it on turkey Thanksgiving. You can use it on anything. Chicken, steak, pork, you name it. You're going to buy seasonings anyways. You might as well buy them from a company that's 100% veteran owned. Plus, they're huge, man. You buy these seasonings, you're good to go for the holidays. Their beef jerky is second to none. That's a great stocking stuffer. I believe they have a subscription on that. I eat that shit all the time. Their sweet and spicy is my favorite. 4-pack, $25. You're good to go. And it's USA American beef. None of that Mexico shit. So I think it's pumped full of like weird steroids or something. Not here. They're using American beef. Go to grillyourassoff.com. Again, 100% veteran owned company. Use the promo code Drinking Bros, 15% off at grillyourassoff.com. Last but not least, definitely not least, grenadesoap.com. It's made with real gunpowder, so you know it's good. They got a bunch of awesome bathing products for dudes. And finally, you can smell like a dude, so you're not using your wife's shit, her bullshit loofah or whatever, you know, cream or lotions or whatever you use on that. No, get a soap on a rope again. The gunpowder thing is real. It's fucking awesome. Big fan of grenadesoap.com. We use that shit all the time, man. They've been on and off the show for the last like 3 years. We love them. We also love the fact they have a taint scrubber. They just have great shit for dudes, products for dudes. The taint scrubber thing's hilarious because, I mean, dude, with ass eating season really taking off like this, scrub up your shit. You don't know if you're going to get flipped over in the middle of the night by your lady. She's going to put a tongue in there. So go to grenadesoap.com. Clean yourself up. Use the promo code Drinking Bros for 20% off at grenadesoap.com. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Jocko.
It is a great day in sunny San Diego. I can't be more excited about today's podcast. I'm a huge fan of this man in particular. I've been listening to his podcast, reading his books, following him now for, I guess, over a year, I would say. So I'm relatively new to the Jocko tribe, for a lack of a better definition. Man, I cannot thank you enough for doing this. I'm super excited, Jocko, to have you on the podcast specifically. I know everybody that follows Drinking Bros and Launch Code is going to be absolutely ecstatic about having you on the fucking show. Yesterday you did this speaking engagement for Clever Talks. I think we could have you, not we, I think you could have probably taken those guys and taken a fucking machine gun nest yesterday. So, Jocko, thank you so much for being on the show, man. And this is awesome.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, first and foremost, if you've been living on the moon and you don't know who Jocko is, can you give us your 2-minute bio as far as who's Jocko?
Yeah, I grew up in a little New England town on a dirt road. I was a really rebellious kid. I joined the military after high school, and I spent 20 years in the military, and then I retired, and that's what I'm doing. That's not even 2 minutes. There you go. I'm hyper efficient.
Like, yeah, hyper efficient. That's like the 30-second overview. I love it.
Yeah, but that's it. That's what I did.
Yeah.
You know, I always wanted to be in the military since I was a little kid, and that's what I did. I feel pretty lucky that I had the opportunity to serve. And then when I retired, I kind of took some of the lessons that I learned in the military and started applying them to the civilian sector.
So what was the defining moment that you knew you wanted to be in the military? Did it start when you were 6, 7, 8, 9, 10?
I don't know when you start to remember things,
right,
as a person. But at whatever time I can remember having thoughts as a human, I wanted to have some kind of machine gun. You know, like, right. I mean, I would take sticks. Every stick that I could find became a machine gun in my hands. Every, right, you know, broom, every hockey stick, just anything that you picked up. I mean, anything that I picked up became a machine gun. And, you know, I did with what all kids do. I take a cork and burn it and then paint my face black and run around the woods and go to old Army Navy stores and get camouflage uniforms. And that's what we did. Shoot each other with BB guns. To get some.
Well, did you have military family members?
So my grandfather was a 20-year Army and he retired as a major. And my dad got kicked out of ROTC in college, which is kind of funny, and he tells me that the military gene skips a generation. So in my direct family, no. Nope. My dad, like I said, my dad got kicked out of ROTC. I think he told me the story. The final straw that broke the camel's back was he had been using some kind of speed spray-on polish for his shoes. And, you know, this is 1950-something, and they were falling behind. They had to be somewhere, so they marched him across this grass, and all the grass stuck to his shoes. So he showed up for inspection, and that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. So that was that.
I can empathize with that. I was kicked out of ROTC in college too. So
there you go.
But I just went enlisted instead. Yeah. So I said, "Fuck you guys. I'm just going to do something else." So
what'd you get kicked out for?
Fighting.
Yeah.
I was a sophomore and I had a junior ahead of me, and we were living in the same house and he was a dick, and I didn't necessarily beat him up, but I definitely hit him a few times, and he didn't like that for some reason, and he wasn't willing to fight back either, which is a whole other thing in the personality and a person's character and personality. That's one of the reasons why I fucking hated him. Right, so he was just cowardly, still is today, I would imagine. So
probably
you can't change genetics. You're not going to stand next to a microwave for a year and become a hero. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So you joined the Navy.
Yep.
Right away. Yep. Yep. So did you know that you wanted to be a SEAL before you joined the Navy?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely didn't join the Navy to be in the Navy.
Right.
I joined because I wanted to be in the SEAL teams, and I had heard about the SEAL teams. And, you know, everyone said it was hard and I liked the water. So, you know, I had a buddy that went, do you remember this program where you could join the Army in between your junior and senior year in high school? And
yeah, the delayed entry program.
But no, you'd go to boot camp.
Yeah.
And I think you'd go to boot camp. You might even go to AIT too.
I think you do both. Yeah.
But anyways, maybe go to both. But anyways, this friend of mine went and he came back and he told me this story. And I heard this story, and the story was they were at Benning, and they're out wherever there's a track, you know, there's like a track and whatever, they're out there doing PT or something, and they're standing around, and there's a guy with There's a guy running on the track, and he's got boots, a t-shirt, cami pants, and he's wearing a rucksack, and he's got a beard, and he's running at a high rate of speed. And my buddy, you know, who's 17, he's like, "Drill sergeant, who's that guy?" And the drill sergeant, you know, and this is my buddy telling me the story, and this is right. also me, you know, dramatizing the story to, you know, make it seem what it seemed like in my head when I was 16.
Right.
The drill sergeant looks, doesn't even look at my friend. He just keeps looking ahead, and he goes, "Delta." And my buddy goes, "Drill sergeant, is there anyone that's tougher than Delta?" And the drill sergeant goes, "SEAL team." And I heard that story. I was like, okay.
Okay.
Well, I know where I'm going. And obviously that's not even remotely true. And as we both know, there's freaking awesome guys in every right. community in the entire military. But when you're 15 or whatever, that's a, it's a decision point for me. And that's kind of what happened. So I heard that story and I got pretty focused on making it the SEAL teams.
That's pretty funny. When I was in a junior, when I was a junior in high school, I actually had a book in my back pocket, and I went over to my girlfriend's house at the time, and her dad was this crazy old guy, really successful, fucking super intense, reminds me kind of like you in a way. And I'm 17, I'm just an asshole, dumb fuck kid, like as all 17-year-olds mm-hmm. typically are. But I had a book about Navy SEALs in Vietnam, and I was an avid Navy SEAL Vietnam reader, mm-hmm. even 16, 17, 18. And this guy stops and he's like, what do you got in that pocket? And I like pulls it out. He's like, "I got another book for you." So he opens up this door in his basement and it's like creaks open, and it's the coolest fucking room I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. Like scuba tanks and just guns and knives yeah. and hatchets and plaques and flags. And I'm like, this, mm-hmm. holy shit. I don't know who this guy is. He was a retired lieutenant colonel, SF guy, worked mm-hmm. for the agency, like just, and he hands me this book. He takes my Navy SEAL book and he hands me this, The History of the Green Berets by Colonel Donald Sutherland. No shit.
Yeah.
And he hands it to me. He's like, "I want you to read this and give it back to me and tell me what you think in a few months." Well, I gave it back to him like a year later.
Yeah.
And I had memorized like every sentence in this thing. Like I knew exactly what I was going to do, right? I'm going to be a Green Beret.
Yeah.
And, but it's funny because at 16 or 17,
yeah.
you know, you're like, I'm
yeah.
doing this.
Yeah. And you just need that little push. You know, if yeah. that would have been an ex-team guy or some force recon guy, you would have been like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have been like, I'm force. I'm yeah. force all the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have ever said like, I'm going to go be an aviation guy. I don't know if I would.
No, well, no, I definitely, I've had that discussion. I never had that kind of desire to fly a plane or even to drive a tank or anything like that. And I love the fact that there are guys that love doing that
mm-hmm.
and that's what they're, I mean, you got to be a, you know, my buddy Dave Burke that's at Echelon Front with me, he's from the Marine Corps, but he's a fighter pilot. And I mean, he's just the most squared away dude ever. And he loved that. And if you don't just want to do that, you're going to hate it because you're landing on an aircraft carrier in the middle of the night. It's just a hard job. It's a hard job. Yeah,
it's a crazy hard job.
Yeah, yeah.
But I never did either. You know, like I just envisioned myself at like 16 with, you know, like this K-bar and the swamp, you know, the Vietnam.
Yeah.
That image of a commando in Vietnam was like, that's what I wanted. You know, with an SF guy, it was like, you got your Hmong or your commando fighting force. You're out off the fucking grid. Nobody's messing with you. You're basically wearing a loincloth and packing a machine gun. And like, that was the image that I was running after,
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So you joined the Navy right out of high school.
Yep.
How long was it before you went to BUDS?
Months. I mean, I just went through boot camp and then.
So you didn't have another MOS before? Nope. Okay. Nope. Nice.
You just rolled.
And did you graduate first time go?
Yep.
Yeah, you didn't get recycled or anything like that?
Nope. I was young and stupid and just, you know, I was a very average athlete growing up, you know, at best, but that's actually not a bad thing in BUDS, at least when I went through, because there was guys that went through around my time frame that were really good at one particular thing, but they would suck at other things, and that's not a good combination.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just...
And you were the youngest guy? Is that what you said yesterday?
No. So in my first SEAL platoons, first two SEAL platoons, I was the youngest guy and the most junior guy. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's basically humble pie every day, right?
Well, it was awesome when you're checking into... When I checked into SEAL Team 1 back in the day, it was freaking awesome. It was just like... It was so cool. You know, like all those... And you didn't really make eye contact with the guys that were, you know, that had been there, because they would beat you up. And
like, for real.
Yeah. There was a lot of... It was a violent atmosphere, right? And so you just kept your eyes down, and you know, just tried to be squared away. And that was my goal. My goal was just to like be as squared away as I could and be a good SEAL. That was my goal. That's what I wanted to do. It was all like in a fun way. It was all hazing, you know, just hazing, getting beat up, getting taped up, getting hung from the rafters, getting put in the dip tank, just all fun, you know, stuff. And it, you know, even at the time, it was kind of fun. You know, I mean, you're like, cool, this is where I want to be. So
I think that's a common misconception with hazing. I really do. People always think like it must, and especially civilians, they're like, oh, I can't believe it. And it's like, I remember having a gladiator drills in the barracks where the senior enlisted would throw beer bottles at you while you held a trash can lid, and you're basically, you know, naked, and they would smoke the living shit out of you. But that was just the deal.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm not worried about it. I don't think less of them.
Oh no, it's pretty fun. Well, and then can people take hazing too far? Absolutely. Yes. People can do. And so it's like you need a hazing safety officer to make sure that things aren't getting totally out of hand. And you know, I had this discussion with some folks. I mean, the hazing that should happen, there's people that make the hazing really, really degrading. Mm-hmm. And is it going to be slightly degrading? Yeah, it's humbling. Like, and that's what happens when you check into the SEAL team. It's like, oh, I just finished the hardest training in the free world.
Right.
I'm a badass. And you show up at a SEAL team, and you know, actually the Master Chief, I checked in with a couple other guys, and we went to check in with the Master Chief of the command. And so the three of us, you know, he goes, come in. So we go into, and we're standing there at like the position of attention, and he points at us and he's like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. Everyone here has been through that training. It doesn't mean shit. You got to prove yourself. And we were like, okay. I mean, that's a cool welcome aboard as far as I'm concerned. So that was pretty neat.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, they think too, that once you graduate selection and training, you're good. You know, you got this tab, or you got this cool thing on your chest, or a hat. It's like, you just started.
It takes a long, long time to where you have any slack whatsoever.
Yeah.
It takes a long time. Because in the SEAL teams, when you mess up, it's everyone knows. If you mess up bad, like for instance, if you have an accidental discharge, every single person on that coast, there's, you know, the coast, there's West Coast and East Coast SEALs. Every single person on that coast will know your name.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll know it forever.
Oh,
so that's like an example. Yeah. And that's if you stay. Because, you know, a lot of times if you have an AD, depending on the situation, that could be the end of your career. So something like that, or even someone, if you get lost.
Oh, yeah.
If you get lost and you require, you know, like some kind of help, that everyone is going to know that. So if you screw up, and that can happen at any point in your career.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of pressure. And that's in my mind, that's what keeps us sharp, is that you don't want to screw up. You don't want to let yourself down. You don't want to let your friends down. You don't want to sully your reputation, and the reputation is everything. So yeah.
Yeah. It's reputation is everything. And I think I had more performance anxiety around not letting my teammates down.
Oh, for sure.
Than anything we ever did. I didn't give a shit about jumping out of a helicopter. That stuff didn't even You didn't even think about it.
Of course. Yeah.
But the performance anxiety.
And one thing, when I was running training, one thing that I tried to shift the focus was there was a lot of stress. When I first came in, there was a lot of stress on like safety and mechanics of, hey, you were more than 6 inches off this wall, you know, you penetrated too deep, whatever. There was a lot of stress on that, and a lot of stress on the mechanics of what you were doing, and that was very stressful when you were coming through the training. When I ran the training, like, not that we took the stress off of that, but I wanted the stress to come from having the leaders need to make decisions in really dynamic, chaotic situations, because that was the stress that I felt overseas that I wanted to simulate for guys. So it was a little shift on where the stress was, and I wanted the stress to be, I wanted guys to feel the pressure of, I need to make a decision right now. This is a terrible scenario. I barely even understand what's happening to my platoon right now, and I need to figure it out, and I need to make a decision. As opposed to, hey, we're going to give you a safety violation because you did these mechanics wrong. Mm-hmm. Not that we didn't do that, but it's not that we took that stuff away. It's this, that we added even more stress. That's the point.
Right. Well, I know you were talking about it yesterday. It's interesting because I spent the last several years of my professional career with the government training advanced tactics, CQB, in developing high pressure scenarios to put basically one and two men into in order to unravel what they were doing. So the technique versus the complex problem-solving ability of the individual, when you're talking about yesterday, I would see that firsthand from the catwalk, and I would purposely build really advanced and technically advanced scenarios that would be more complicated than most anything they would ever see, in order to induce the situation where they had to think and make really advanced decisions, not about how... I don't care about whether or not you're penetrating the room, you know, 3 feet and then collapsing your sector of fire. I want you to penetrate the room to the point in which you can clear the majority of the dead space and collapse your sector of fire where it makes sense, because you can read the tactical situation and you're penetrating based on that. Not a dance rehearsal thing.
Yeah,
right?
And again, totally.
Right.
And to anyone that's listening that's thinking, well, that's, you know, you can't get away from the fundamentals. I'm not saying that. You're not saying that.
No.
You absolutely have to have the fundamentals. You have to have the mechanics down. Once you get the mechanics down, let's induce more stress that people have to think through problems, because you can get better at thinking through problems. Mm-hmm. You can get better at pattern recognition, and also learning how to detach, which I talk about all the time. And that was, to me, is one of the biggest advantages that you have as a leader, is if you can step back off the firing line 2 feet, you see infinitely more than anyone else that's staring down the sights of their weapon. And that allows you to make really good decisions, as opposed to staying right up there on the firing line and not moving your head and not looking around, and you're going to make bad decisions.
So, you know, when we're talking about scenarios, and now I think that one of the things that I was thinking about yesterday when you were talking is, you've got a bunch of guys that are transitioning out of the mill, and they've had an immense amount of structure in their life. They've had great management or mediocre management, depending on where they are. They've had great leaders, mediocre leaders, but they've had structure. And they've been put into scenarios, especially in special operations. You're thrown into scenario after scenario after scenario. Then you're galvanizing that with your experience. One of the things that I was thinking about was, how do you take that, or those lessons learned in the military, distill those down into the things that you need to put in your briefcase and pack out of the military with? I get that question a lot, which is, guys aren't thinking about, and I'll just use that example, is I wrote thousands of op orders, right? Mm-hmm. And I had to write one for my own departure out of service. I had to write my mission statement. Guys are thinking about, I have all these skills, but they're not thinking about how to translate those as they transition. What were some of the things that you were doing in order to make that happen?
Well, if you're talking about me individually, I did a pretty bad job of all that. I was all in for the SEAL teams, and that's really the only thing that I thought about. What happened to me was the last few years I was in, I was running the training for the West Coast SEALs, and the training was very advanced, and really I focused a lot on combat leadership. And so I had prepared a brief that I would give, and it was that simple. It's, you know, they called the Jocko brief. Like, this is what we're going to talk about, the fundamental principles of combat leadership. And that didn't exist. Like, when I went through training, no one pulled the leaders aside and said, okay, here are the fundamental principles that you need to know to lead on the battlefield. The Army, the Marine Corps, they do that very, very well. You have great doctrine. I think it's FM7 TAC 6, I might be wrong, but it's rifle, platoon, and squad.
FM 7-8.
Yeah. You look at that thing, and it's like, here is what your job is. Here are your roles and responsibilities for the platoon commander, the first sergeant. It's like right on down the line. And we didn't have that in the SEAL teams.
Right.
And, okay, now that's a bad thing. It's also a good thing, because your strengths are often your weaknesses are often your strengths. In the SEAL teams, we didn't have doctrine. We literally had almost no doctrine in the SEAL teams. And so what that meant was, everybody, you could throw a mission at us that no one had ever done before.
Right.
And we'd look at it and go, okay, let's figure out how to get it done. And we'd do a better job of getting it done than if we had been always using doctrine all the time, and we were told, hey, oh, it's a direct action mission, here's how you do it. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's an ambush, here's how you do it. We would literally have something that would be handed down on a piece of paper. Hey, this is how we did ambushes last time, and I got this from this guy, and he got it from that guy, and that's how we would learn. But it wasn't written down anywhere. From the leadership perspective, it definitely wasn't anywhere. And so when I took over that training and realized, I literally realized the first night that I went on a training operation with a SEAL platoon that did a horrible job and was a total disaster, and was all because of the leadership. And I realized, okay, I've got to teach these people what I know. Mm-hmm. And I've got to do it in a very quick way. I've got to simplify things. I've got to distill it down into something they can understand and implement very quickly. And that's when I wrote down the four laws of combat, which is what became the book Extreme Ownership. And I took that, and that's what I was doing. So for my last couple years, my last almost 3-4 years, I was just running that training over and over and over again, and seeing all these leaders go through this training and seeing what mistakes they'd make, and getting the platoon that was outside the box, getting them back in the box, right, getting the leaders that were not making good decisions, getting them to make good decisions, getting rid of leaders that couldn't cut it. I mean, that's what I was doing. So as I was getting ready to retire, I knew a guy that was the CEO of a company, and he came to me and said, hey, can you talk to my executives about leadership? And I said, yeah, sure. And so I went and talked, and when I got done, I basically redid. I had gotten the brief that I used to give to the SEAL leaders. I had talked to some soft caucus. I talked to a civilian governmental group that not everyone had secret clearances. Mm-hmm. So I had to go through my chain of command, and my chain of command declassified the brief. So I had a declassified version of this brief, thank God.
Right.
And, you know, they pulled out whatever we couldn't talk about, and it was just these principles. So I went and gave that brief. And when I got done, the CEO came up to me and said, I want you to do this for every division of my company. And I was like, okay. And so I started doing that, and then at one of those divisional meetings, the CEO of the parent company was there, and he said, I want you to come and talk to all my CEOs. And I went and talked to all the CEOs, and then a number of those CEOs came up to me and said, can you come and do this for my company? And at that time, Leif Babin, who was one of my platoon commanders that worked for me in the Battle of Ramadi, he had just gotten out, he had moved to New York, he was getting married or just got married. And I said, hey, man, I need some backup over here. You know, we got some business to do. And, you know, that was it. He came on board, and that was how it started. So to your point of how did I know what to put in my kit bag when I departed, I didn't.
Right.
I didn't really know. But what I can tell people now, and this is why we started another company called EF Overwatch, you know, Echelon Front Overwatch, mm-hmm. is what these civilian companies need. And I work with civilian companies just about every day. What they need, and what you talked about, is what people in the military have is they have leadership skills.
Right.
That's what they have. And they don't. What people don't realize is how valuable those leadership skills are. And to a company in the civilian sector to be able to take a person that has the leadership skills are the hardest things to get out of someone. If there's some technical skill that you know or that you don't know, like you need to learn about manufacturing or you need to learn about sales of a particular product, like a military guy can pick that up. But what it's harder for a civilian to pick up is like, oh, leadership. How do I lead people? But you take a military guy that's been in for 16 years and he's done multiple combat deployments. He knows how to figure things out. He knows how to get a team oriented in the right direction and moving towards a target and get a mission accomplished. That's what he knows. And so that's what you bring out. What you bring out of the military is your leadership skills, working with people. Now, as you and I both know, and this is a huge caveat, just because you're in the military doesn't mean you're a good leader. And right. there's people that come out of the military that are awful leaders. Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time in the beginning because we got asked for a long time, how can we get, you know, we want to recruit military people. I want military people at my company. And I had a hard time giving like the blanket, yes, just go hire veterans and you'll be stoked.
Right.
Because there's also veterans, you know, if you led like a tyrant in the military and you think you're going to lead like that in the civilian sector, it's going to be horrible. It was already horrible when you were in the military. You just didn't know it as well. Because you got, well, why is that? The reason is because in the military, as you know, you do your job for 2 years and then you're going to get placed in another position of leadership somewhere else. So you can barely survive that thing and boom, you got a clean slate. And that's right. How people get promoted. It's not like this long track record of where you got to lead a team for 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. And eventually, if you're not good, because what are the guys saying? They're like, hey, we'll just put it up for another. It takes them 6 months to figure out that you're an idiot.
Right.
And then another 6 months to go, wow, we confirmed this guy's an idiot. And then there's a year left. They'll suffer through it because it's going to be a pain in the ass to try and get rid of you. And then you leave and they get a new boss and they're happy. So you can survive through the military being a bad leader. That being said, good leaders in the military, they've been tried, they've been trained, and they've been tested, and that value is immense.
I struggle with this even today. I think with our company and our companies articulating how important leadership is and then differentiating for my managers and chiefs the difference between technical proficiency, management, and leadership, and being able to bucket all of those things and then combine them into one element. For guys coming out of the military that are expecting to work with civilians, there's a communication gap. And I think there's a combination of things that I have my opinion as far as those communication gaps are, but what are the things that you've seen between corporate America, military guys making the transition into corporate America, and what the expectation should be for military guys transitioning over?
Yeah, the technical aspect, like you talked about, is you're not going to know that stuff. You're not going to know about whatever manufacturing process down a line. You're just not going to know it. It takes time, just like it took time for you to figure out what you're going to do in your military job. It's going to take some time to figure out what the technical side of your civilian job is going to be. So you've got to be, and this is a tough one, you got to be humble.
Yeah.
And you got to recognize, okay, you know what? I don't know this and I'm going to need some support and I'm going to need some help. And the other thing is, and this is just a leadership, a snag of leadership that trips everyone up. People think if I'm the leader, I should know everything. And that's actually not true at all. And people think if I'm the leader and I admit that I don't know something, my team is going to think I'm weak.
Right.
And that's not true either. So if you roll into a situation, I mean, if you think about it from a combat perspective, if you were in some AO and you had been there for 6 months and I roll in and I'm doing an op in your AO, and I say, hey, Evan, what's going on? I'm Jocko. Hey, we're going to hit this target over here. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. If you could just stay out of my way, out of my, you know, space tonight, I'd appreciate it. Right? What do you think of me?
Right.
You just think I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
If I come in, hey, Evan, what's going on? I'm Jocko. We've been down south. I know you've been in this AO for a while. Hey, this is the target we're supposed to hit. I have a totally open mind. How would you hit it? What would you do? Do you want to come with me?
Can you come?
Want to lead it? I mean, I don't care. Because the most important thing to me is accomplishing the mission. Mm-hmm. Now, when you see me do that, you go, oh, okay, this guy's, he's in charge, but he's a humble guy. I'm going to help him out. We're going to move forward. We're going to accomplish the mission. So if you have that attitude, and what's interesting is it's so easy to see that from the outside.
Right.
But it's hard to convince yourself that that's actually true when you're in these positions. So when you get in the civilian sector, you got to be humble. And if you have that attitude, like you want to learn, and then you and you still have those leadership techniques, you're going to do fine.
This is a super interesting conversation and a point for me, because I deal with it in the company where, and I really want to know what your thoughts are around this. Why are people, what are the insecurities, or at least from your perspective, that are driving kind of a rice bowl situation where they've got their 10 acres, they don't want to share, they silo specific responsibilities, and it's super counterproductive. You just mentioned several reasons, and I see it all the time, and I look at it like a cancer that needs to be cut out.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What do you,
ego.
It's all ego.
It's a lot of it is ego.
Right.
Now, is there some, hey, job security there?
Right.
You know, yes, there is. Is there some, but most of it's ego. Most of it's, hey, I don't want to make this person look good. I want to protect what I've got over here. And that's one of, you know, I was my task unit, when we deployed to Ramadi. This was 2006. It was a very volatile area of Iraq at the time. And when we were there, we were just complete brothers with the Army and with the Marine Corps. And that's because the fight was hard, right?
Right.
The Army colonel at the time, who retired as a general, McFarland, just an outstanding guy. But he if you could help him, he was all about it.
Right.
If he could help you, he was all about it. If they could help me, I was all about it. If we could help them, all about it. Marine Corps, same way. So I always look back at it, you know, and there was like literally no inter-service rivalry at all. And even you know, when you get, and you've seen this, I know you've seen this, you know, you get like a battalion that's got one AO, and then the next battalion over, they don't cooperate with each other, because, and like there wasn't barely even that. So I think if you can get people to recognize, like, hey, there's something real that we're trying to accomplish here. And it's bigger than just your department.
Right.
And if your department, this is the way we talk about cover and move. You know, cover and move, which, you know, obviously I don't need to explain to you, but hey, we're going to work together to close with and destroy the enemy. While I'm shooting, you're going to move. And when you start shooting, I'm going to move. It's really simple. Well, when I first started working with companies, I didn't even think I was going to teach that, which, by the way, that's the first law of combat that I wrote down, is cover and move. That's the most simple thing.
Right.
Is you've got to work together as a team. That's what it is. That's what cover and move is. Well, I didn't think that would translate to civilians, because they're not in machine gun fights.
Right.
The first CEO I sat down with, and I said, well, what are these problems that you're having? And he was like, well, I got this department over here, and I got this division over here, and I got this other department over here, and they don't work with each other, and they don't talk to each other, and they don't tell each other what's going on. And I said, oh, they don't cover and move. And he's like, what does that mean? And I explained it to him. He's like, yes, that's it. So if your sales department isn't communicating with your operations department, things are going to fall apart, and vice versa. So, and if you're sales department isn't working with your marketing department, and they aren't telling each other what they need and what's doing well and what help they, then guess what? Things are going to fall apart. If your logistics group isn't supporting your sales group, I mean, you have to get people to come together. And if they don't, it's problematic.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because I see it, and even when you try to force it as a manager, as a leader, when I'm trying to force communication and put people at the same table, drive the direct communication between divisions and departments, there's still a hesitation in a lot of the different division or department heads at times in order to fully communicate. Have you read Principles by Ray Dalio?
I have not.
That? So one of the things he talks about is radical transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And I've personally been trying to force this idea of just getting everything out, like get it all out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we talk about leadership and we talk about management, getting your perspective and saying, how do you get your people to just communicate with candor? Like, how do you do it?
Yeah, and there's a dichotomy to that.
Right. Right?
There's a dichotomy, because can you communicate with too much candor? Yes. Can you be too radically transparent? Yes, you can.
Right.
And how does that happen? Well, it's when I come to you and say, Evan, your department did not support me. We failed. It's your fault. That might be what I truly believe. Is that the right way to approach it? No,
right.
It's not. I got asked this question the other day. It was a woman that worked in one department in a company. And she says, and it was accounting.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you know, I work in accounting, And what am I supposed to do when I need these numbers from these groups and some of the groups will not give me the numbers on time? What am I supposed to do? I asked them 50 times and they don't give me the numbers and it fouls up my whole system. What should I do? How do I even take ownership? You're talking about ownership.
Right.
How do I take ownership of that? And I said to her, hey, if I'm working in accounting and there's a group that's not giving me the numbers that I need, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down there, I'm going to knock on their door, and I'm going to say, hey, I know it's Tuesday afternoon, and I know you know the numbers are due tomorrow. I don't know what you got going on. I'm sure you're really busy. What can I do to help you get these numbers to me? Can we sit down for 15 minutes? Because I know it's a little harder for you to see the numbers. If you show me your folders here, I can pull them out. We can get this done, and we can get this mission accomplished. It's like, okay. The assumption that they're lazy, the assumption that they're weak, the assumption that they're not doing their job, instead of assuming, hey, maybe they've got more going on than I do.
Right.
And what I'm asking for them for is too much. So if you and I are in a firefight and you're not shooting your weapon and I just immediately think Evan's running away or Evan's not putting down cover fire for me, this is pathetic, and I start yelling on the radio, instead of, when I go, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you putting down cover fire? Instead I say, Evan, are you good? And you can come back and say, actually, we're pinned down from another direction. I need other support, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to me attacking you. So, and then what happens is, okay, where does that escalate to? Because it could escalate to, well, an accounting person, now I'm just going to go do everyone's job now? Is that what's happening?
Right.
Actually, no. If I have to go into your department and this other department and this other department, I've got to get in there and get their numbers because they're too busy. Well, guess what? In a month or 2 months of me working too hard, of me working an 80-hour week, I raise my hand to the boss and I say, hey, boss, I want to let you know what's going on. This is what the people on the front lines are doing, and when I need the numbers, they can't give them to me for this reason.
Right.
What I need is one more person on my team that can spend time in each one of these departments and gather those numbers up so we can be more efficient. So eventually, you correct the whole problem. As opposed to attacking someone. It's the opposite of cover and move.
Right.
It's like, hey, you're not covering for me. Cool. I'm going to start shooting at you. Right. Like, oh, Evan's not shooting for me right now. I'm going to start drilling him in the back.
Right.
Right. Is that even a remote possibility? No, I would never do that. Why do we do it in the business world? Because it's not so obvious that's what we're doing. So when someone, I'd say this, if it's you and me as partners, right, and you're not carrying, you show up late for work 3 days in a row, what do I do? People ask me this question, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, well, first of all, whatever, Evan needed to get done in the morning, I'm going to try and get it done for him.
Right.
My assumption is Evan has some sick kid at home. My assumption is his wife is sick. My assumption is the water heater broke or whatever. And I'm going to cover for him. And guess what? What does that do with our relationship? When you come in and you're like, hey, sorry, I'm late. And I go, hey, man, don't worry about it. I got your part of the project covered. We're good. What does that do to our relationship?
It's positive team building.
Positive team building, yep. Situation. We just got stronger as a team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as opposed to you come in and I go, you're late, waiting on you.
Right.
And by the way, I told the boss, if this is late, it's because you didn't get your stuff done. Right. What does that do to our relationship? What does that do to our team? It's horrible.
Confrontation.
And by the way, what happens 3 weeks later when I'm late because my water heater broke?
Mm-hmm.
And if the last time I dimed you out, you're going to dime me out. You're going to bask in the glory of me being a loser, and you're going to report me to the boss, and we have a horrible working relationship, and everything fails. As opposed to, if I would have helped you before, when I'm late, you're like, hey, send me a text that says, hey, you're running late, all good. Don't even bother coming in till lunch because I got you covered. Boom. Now we got a team that's working together to try and take care of each other. Now the question becomes, well, what if Evan just keeps not doing his part of the projects? Now what are you going to do? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you don't want to do your part of the projects and you're going to let me do them, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to do them. I'm going to do them, and I'm going to keep doing them until I've absorbed your whole job. And now I realize that you actually don't want to be part of this team. If you don't want to be a part of this team, you're not going to be part of this team.
Right.
You're going to be gone. People that want to work and want to get after it, you're going to be part of the team. Because eventually, if I start taking your job from you and you'd be saying, hey, Jago, no, hey, man, I'm sorry I missed that a couple times. Let me get this back. And a matter of fact, let me grab this other thing from you. And okay, cool. Now we're working together. So that's what you got to develop within your team. And again, that's where
radical transparency.
Radical transparency. My gut might be, this lazy bastard is late again. I'm not going to let that radical transparency out. I'm going to actually stifle my little pathetic emotions, and I'm going to assume that you tried to do the right thing, but you can't for whatever reason, and I'm going to have your back because that's how I roll.
That's interesting because we've got over 50% of the company's veteran, and the communication that we see on a daily basis, it actually defines the culture. There's a lot of different things there that are this soup of activity that is the ecosystem of the company. And one of the big things that I'm trying to work on, I think a ton of people would provide some value, is creating a more positive team environment through communication, which would be candor, right? You definitely have to get to the root of problems. Like you got to cut to the bone. You can't waste time from my perspective. You can't pontificate about a bunch of bullshit. You got to go right to it. You know, how do you get right to it with candor and respect in order to solve the problem while creating a positive team environment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a real simple tactical solution to this. It's so simple, it's shocking. And I kind of talked about it yesterday when I talked at that speech that I gave. When there's a problem and you want to use this radical candor, instead of pointing the radical candor at your team, point it at yourself.
Right.
You point it at yourself. Because give me an example of something that goes wrong at your company.
We use a lot of paid for service or services, and you'll have different forms of those services that need oversight. And if we don't necessarily have the appropriate amount of oversight, they won't be managed appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
So then you'll have to go back to the individual manager and you'll have to say, okay, these are your three accounts. They're not delivering. Why?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it happens.
Yeah,
it happens several times a month.
So several times a month, from my perspective, when I ask that question, hey, Bill, hey, Bill, what's going on? Hey, I see that there's been some problems with these services, and I know you're in charge of them. And what I'm thinking is I'm not giving you the support that you need to make this happen properly, because we've missed three times now this month, which, as you know, and also I want to kind of explain to you, because I don't think I've done a good job of explaining to you what happens when we miss. When your three projects or whatever over here, when these things miss, I want to show you what happens down the chain. So it throws this off, it throws this off, it throws this other thing off, which, by the way, is something that we can't even recover. We'll never make that up.
Right.
So that's a real problem. So I don't think I've really done a good job of explaining to you how this affects everyone else down the line. The other thing I'm wondering is, do you have the support that you need to get this done? Mm-hmm. Because I feel like I've always felt like, you know, I like to decentralize and I want to just have you run things, but I might have put you out here so far that you need more support. So what I want to do is like, well, what can I do to help? What can I do to make sure that this doesn't happen anymore? Because we and I've told you what the details are. We actually can't let this happen anymore.
Right.
So what does that do? Instead of that person thinking that you're blaming them and you're pointing the finger at them, they're actually thinking, they should be thinking two things. Number one, I need to do a better job. I didn't realize what all these after effects were. And number two, this guy might start micromanaging me if I don't get my act together. And that is actually a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
If you work for me and you're squared away, I'll be the most decentralized boss you've ever dreamt of in your life. If you're not squared away, you're going to figure out what micromanagement is. No one likes to get micromanaged. And I won't micromanage you offensively. And by offensively, I mean like I won't micromanage you to the point where you get mad in the beginning. Because I'm going to give you a chance. I'm going to micromanage you. Instead of checking in on you once a week, all of a sudden I'm checking in every 2 days. Because, I mean, how long do you go without checking in with Bill and making sure that those services are on the path? Right now, you give him like a month. Hey, you don't even check on him till he's late. And so I'm going to change. I'm not saying you specifically, but as a boss, you're saying, oh, I didn't check on these until they were late. And then they're late. Now I got to go do something about it. Next time, I'm checking every other day. I'm in there. Hey, where are we at? What do we need to do to tighten this up? And eventually they figure out what the parameters of success are and they start making it happen on their own. Then I check them, you know, twice a week. Then I check them once a week. And then we're back to checking them once a month. Now, some people, when you give them that much rope, they'll start, they might not hang themselves, but they'll get it knotted up.
Right.
And that's when I'll figure out where that balance of the balance, this dichotomy of micromanagement versus hands off decentralized command. And when I find that balance with that individual worker or subordinate, that's what I'm going to go with.
This is, so this happens a ton in business, obviously, all across my business. And I know the guys that I know in the industry that are managers and CEOs, it's proper management and then giving people enough latitude where they feel they're autonomous and they're fulfilled based on they get to make their own decisions, not giving them enough support because you don't know. And this happens a lot with military guys that I've seen, is they won't ask for support.
Yep.
So you'll have that conversation we just had, which is a walk down to, you know, Kevin's office and say, hey, dude, what can I do in order to facilitate more success? Because we dropped these three timelines, we're a week late, your reporting's late. These are all the things that are wrong with this. What can I do to help you? I got it. You know what? Last week was... It was a busy week. You know, my wife was sick. Yep. Like, hey, okay, roger that, man. I'm going to come back next week. We're going to talk about it again. But it keeps happening.
Yeah. So this is what I call the escalation of counseling.
Right.
So it starts off with you know, hey, Evan, hey, we were late three times, bro. You understand that we can't be late, right? I mean, this is like on you. This right. is your department. And when we're late, it hurts everyone. You got that, right? And you're like, yeah, hey, man. It's like, okay, I just want to make sure you knew that. Because, like I said, we can't be late. And sometimes that'll correct the problem, you know, and Evan will buckle down a little bit and do things a little bit better. Sometimes it doesn't. And then, you know, next week, hey, we were late three times again with our numbers. This we talked about this last week, and you know, you told me you had some things going on, but this is 2 weeks in a row. Like, you understand that this is important, right? And you know, you say, yeah, hey, this is what's going on, and this is, I'll fix it. And maybe that fixes the problem. And maybe I've pointed out a couple things, you know, hey, do this a little bit different. Pull this person over here. You know, maybe I've given you a little bit of guidance to help you correct that situation.
Right.
Some nice gentle guidance. Little suggestions, and maybe that you take those suggestions and you implement them, and maybe everything's cool. Or of course, maybe it's not. Maybe you didn't listen, and maybe you, and now all of a sudden I got to go in there, and it's escalating. Right now,
yep.
It's hey, listen, Evan. Okay, this is now 3 weeks in this situation. I'm actually talking to you right now for the last time that I'm only talking. If I have this discussion with you again, I'm actually going to have to write you up, which is not something I want to do, but I want to make sure that you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth right now,
right?
Which is, we need to get this fixed. What do you need to fix it? If you need something from me, tell me right now. If you can handle it on your own, then it better be fixed, or I'm actually going to have to go to paper on this.
Right.
And we're bros. That's not supposed to happen. Come on. Get in the game. And now Evan realizes, like, oh my God, I didn't realize Jocko's going to actually write me up, but I'm not going to let that happen. And you take those suggestions and you fix everything, and that's cool. Or you don't. In which case, now I'm coming in, where I'm writing it down. I'm telling you exactly what you need to do. I'm telling you what the exact expectations are. I'm telling you what the corrective measures are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also going to tell you what the consequences are of you not achieving what I need you to achieve. And, you know, then it's crystal clear. You look at it, you know what you're supposed to do, and you've got the actual course corrections. Hey, I want you to do this process different. I want you to pull this person over here. I want you to fix these things. And you go and you do those things, and it's cool. And I walk in 3 months later with that piece of paper, and I put it in the shredder like we used to do in the teams,
yeah.
Right? No problem, no factor. It's all in the past. We're good. Thanks for straightening that out. Or you don't straighten it out. And now I'm going to execute whatever I told you I was going to execute, whether I'm going to move you to a different department that doesn't have as much stress, or I'm going to, you know, put you in a different, or I'm going to fire you.
Right.
Whatever that's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons we feel bad as leaders when we fire someone is because we haven't done what we know we should have done as a leader to take care of that person, to coach them, to mentor them.
Right.
And I use those words. I always put a little weird tone in my voice when I talk about coaching and mentoring. The reason I do that is because almost no one wants to get coached and mentored. Like, it's offensive to just about every single person in the world to get coached and mentored. Because when I say, Evan, you know, I'm going to give you some coaching here. Like, that is just, it's just automatically, what does that mean? It means that you don't know anything. It means that I'm the superior being, and I'm going to coach you. Listen, you know what you need? You need some good mentoring from me, and don't worry, Evan, I'm going to do that for you. People just go. Now, are there some people that are humble enough to be like, oh, man, that's outstanding. I can't wait for you to, you know, help me get better. There's some people like that, like 0.01% of the population. Right. So it's more about developing a relationship where, when we're talking, you don't even see me. You don't even see the flanks that I'm coming onto you, that I'm hitting you from. For you, you just walk away from a conversation you had with me with new ideas in your head about how you're going to do your job better, and you're not even exactly sure where they came from, but they seem pretty good, and you're going to give them a try. That's optimal. Now, there's a dichotomy with this, because if I'm using this form of kind of indirect communication with you to make suggestions and it's not having the impact that you need to move you in the right direction, then I need to become more and more direct. And so there's a dichotomy in communication. Can you be too direct in communication? Yes, you can. Well, if I can be so direct with you that you reject it and you just get mad at me,
right?
I can be so indirect that you don't receive the information that you need and you don't make any changes. So I have to constantly modulate and balance that dichotomy and find out what I need to do to get Evan to do what I need him to do. And that's leadership, by the way.
Yeah, and this is something that we struggle with, I think, across the board. I think managers, leaders, across the board, it's effective communication, getting the right point across, understanding how you can emphasize the priorities, get everybody in line with what the mission of the company is, whether that's a Q4 objective, whether it's a financial goal, whatever that is. And one of the things that I really try to emphasize is, how do you have hard conversations with your employees and your subordinates? Because psychologically, people avoid that like a fucking hot stove.
Yep.
And I look at it like procrastination. You talked about it yesterday. If I know and I feel like there's a hard conversation that needs to happen, that's the conversation I actually need to have. That's the one I need to have.
Yes. And to bring that point home even further, if we're on the battlefield and there's a problem in a room, like we hear, whether it's shots fired, whether we hear screaming, if we ignore that problem, is it going to get better or is it going to get worse? It's going to get worse.
Right.
You have to go and deal with the problem. The hard conversations that we're talking about, even in the escalation of counseling that I just kind of went through, the early conversation is actually, it's actually not even a negative conversation. It's a positive conversation. It's me saying, hey, Evan, I know you were late to work. Is everything okay?
Right.
Do you, you know, are you good? Is everything okay at home? Do you need a day off? I mean, that's right. Like a positive conversation.
Yeah.
Then the next conversation is like, okay, the next conversation might be hard, but it's only like a level one hard.
Mm-hmm.
If I have that conversation, the chances are that's going to put you course correction and we're going to be okay. So if you have the hard conversations earlier, they're easier. The longer I wait to have the hard conversation, the harder that conversation is going to be, the more direct you have to be, and it's going to be harder. Now, can you not do it? There's no avoiding it now.
Right.
Right? So you actually have to have it. Another little, just a straight up tactical methodology when you have to have a hard conversation with someone, because we're all just big wimps when it comes to having hard conversations. So what I used to do, and I didn't have to do this very often, and the reason I didn't have to do it very often is because I always had the less hard conversations earlier. Like, if you were getting out of line, I wouldn't wait. I'd be like, hey, bro, you need to straighten this out, man. This is not good. That's exactly how I'd say it. I wouldn't say it like attacking you. I'd be like, bro, you cannot, you know, hey, man, you're in charge of a platoon here, man. You can't show up looking like this. That's ridiculous.
Right.
Just a conversation like that, you know? And sometimes guys would be like, oh, man, that's it. You know, and occasionally someone would blow that off and be like, I don't need to listen to this guy. You know, when I was running training, I'd say, hey, man, you're the platoon commander, and you're getting up to brief your boys, and you got a big fat dip in your mouth, and you're spitting in the middle of your brief. Like, I get it, but guess what? Step it up a little, man. Come on. Step it up. It's a one-hour brief. Step it up. Be professional. Your guys will affect it. And 99% of the time, the guys would be like, check. And they'd come into their next brief looking squared away, and it'd be like, check, this guy gets it. Occasionally, there'd be someone that, hey, that's not important. I'm John Wayne, you know, and I'm going to do what I do. And it's like, okay, well, let's, hey, man, here's what's going on. The reason I told you that is because when you're briefing, you're not just briefing your platoon.
Mm-hmm.
You're briefing your platoon. You're going to be briefing battalion commanders. You're going to be briefing. You're going to be sitting talking to a brigade commander. And your boys are going to be with you. And if you always brief like a jackass, and all of a sudden you try and change, the guys are going to be caught off guard, and they're going to be unprofessional because that's what they're used to. So step it up, man. This is a real thing. So you have the earlier you have those conversations, the easier they are. Now, what I was going to say is when I did have to have hard conversations because for whatever reason, maybe someone just wasn't getting it, I would write down the bullet points, the right. 9 things I was going to tell them. I would print them out, 2 copies, one for me, one for them. When they'd come in, it would be sitting on the desk looking at them. Now I just painted myself into a corner. There is no escape in the hard conversation when you put that piece of paper in front of them. Now, this is the dichotomy, though. And this is where, when we talk about radical transparency and radical candor and those things, radical transparency and radical candor is not permission to be an asshole to people.
Right.
And if I'm an asshole to you because I believe in radical transparency, am I doing anything to build a relationship with you? No. I'm not. I'm actually going in the reverse direction. What's the most important thing to me as a leader is that I have a good relationship with you. Now, does that mean that I coddle you? No, it doesn't, because coddling you actually doesn't build a good relationship. It doesn't build a good relationship at all. What builds a good relationship is being balanced between like, hey, Evan's been grinding super hard. You know what? I'm giving him Friday off, and I'm giving him a bonus. Like, I'm going to take care of him. He's been at it hard for, 68 days straight.
Right.
Guess what? I'm giving him some downtime. That's builds a relationship. It doesn't build a relationship to say, oh, Evan, you can take another day off even though you haven't been doing your job, because is that really helping you? No. Do you respect me? No. Is it going to help us accomplish our mission? No. All those things are negative. So you have to do that fine line between being, being disciplined and at the same time allowing people to have freedom. You got to balance that dichotomy. It's a very hard thing to do. But building the relationships with your team, and when you smash them, because your radical candor, you're just going to get after it. Hey, this is the way to, it's like that doesn't build a relationship. There's better ways to do it.
And I see this a lot, which is you've got,
by the way, and I just gotta say this, by the way, no one expects me to say that. No one expects Big Jocko to come in here and say like, no, I'm not going to attack my, the machine gunner and say, you shot outside the front. You know what I'd say? It's like, okay, hey man, I don't know what I did wrong during the brief to put you in a situation where you didn't understand what your field of fire is.
Right.
But we got to make sure that never happens again. Like thank God where you shot, there was no civilians and there was no friendlies, but you were so far out of line that I can't believe it. And I don't know what I did wrong, but you need to talk to me right now and communicate to me what you didn't understand so that this never happens again. We hold and maintain our fields of fire. That's that. That's a different way of talking to someone than telling them that they're screwed up, telling them that they're an idiot, telling them that, all those negative things.
Right.
That doesn't build our relationship. Mm-hmm. And I'm not looking to do that. I'm not looking to do that with anyone that's on my team.
Well, and I've seen this a lot, especially with managers, where I've had to come back and counsel managers and talk to them, where what they'll do is they'll delay a hard conversation. So instead of having that early positive conversation ever in this first cycle of this,
oh, yeah,
then they'll keep punting, keep punting, keep punting, keep punting. Mm-hmm. And then the next recommendation is we got to terminate, Dan.
Yep.
Because
that happens at so many companies.
And then when you try to explain it, and you have to come back and actually explain it to them, how many conversations have you had with them about their performance and their performance issues? Mm-hmm. How many times do you think they come back with none?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny this is a good conversation, because when I went into the civilian sector, my vision of the civilian sector was, oh, if someone's not doing their job, they work for you. You just fire them, yeah, right?
Mine too.
And guess what the civilians think of the military? The civilians think of the military, oh, well, if someone's not doing their job in the military, you just order them to do it, and right. they do it because they have to, because they'll get put in the stockades or whatever it is that they think.
right.
The fact of the matter is, in both situations, you have to counsel people. You have to have paperwork. You have to actually counsel them, written counseling, and explain what their performance shortfalls are. You have to do that in both arenas. But to your point, yeah, that happens all the time. People don't want to have those hard conversations that are a little easier earlier. Now, one thing that I look at there, when I'm in a position, I look at that's my fault as the leader, because that's an actual... It's an actual jiu-jitsu move, right? It's an actual jiu-jitsu move, and some people don't know that yet. They don't know right. that, hey, there's a way to have that. They don't recognize that that you have to tell people things earlier. And so if I've failed as a leader to let them know, like, listen, the longer you let people get out of line and the further they go out of line, the harder it is to bring them back on track, and there's some situations where you can't bring them back on track.
Right.
So you need to tighten up your leash, and the way you do that is by actually having more conversations that might seem a little bit rough, but believe me, if you have them early and you have them often, you're going to end up in a much better position. So if I haven't taught my subordinate leadership how to do that, that's my fault, and I'm going to show them that. We got to remember that these are skills. And this is a type of thing that not everyone in the military get. You know, this is the type of thing when I was saying, like, not everyone in the military is a good leader. Well, yeah, this is a type of thing where some people never developed the skill. They never got to see someone. You know, I had some incredibly great leaders that I worked for, and these are the things that I watched them do. I watched them, you know, I watched a guy when I would screw something up, never, like, actually make me feel just like horrific guilt. Not anger, not defensiveness, just guilt that I did. Man, I can't believe I let my boss down. I can't believe that feels awful to let my boss down. And I had other guys where I screwed something up. They were awful leaders, and it was an offensive attack on me, and all my thought in my own head, Mr. Extreme Ownership, my right. thought was, you know, 19, 20 years old, this guy should never, he didn't give me that information in time. That's ridiculous. How could I have ever prepared those radios, or how could I ever known this was going to happen? That's crap. And that's the difference. That's the difference.
Well, and sometimes you're right. Sometimes it is their fault. I mean, and that's, I guess that's the thing, is where, you know, I was listening to yesterday with owning it and understanding the ownership part of that, but then being professional mm-hmm. and then shifting the psychology is a positive thing in that ownership, because even if you know they fucked it up,
mm-hmm.
take it on.
Well, I was about to say, you go ahead and present me with an example where it's the guy on the front line's fault. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to give me an example where it's the problem of the person, of the subordinate. It's literally almost impossible. Machine gunner, I mean, you come up with an example. Come up with the craziest example you can of a platoon or of a squad, and something goes wrong.
Exactly. I see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you could say, hey,
if you have a negligent discharge, I must not have trained you effectively in order to have an, because you had an ND. So you yep. obviously need more training, and it's my fault.
And you want to take that one step further, where a guy intentionally does something, or he does right. something that's stupid,
gets in a fight in a bar.
Guess whose yeah. fault that is? Mine. Why are you on the team? Because that is the end, right?
Right.
And this is another problem that we run into as leaders. If you take extreme ownership of, like, okay, if my subordinate's doing something wrong, it's my fault. And you can drive that where now I just keep taking ownership of all these screw-ups that the person does without recognizing what you actually should be doing. You've done all the coaching and mentoring and help that you can. What this person needs to do is a different job.
Right.
And maybe it's not within your organization.
that's
yeah. understandable. And this is a psychology that I would see a lot in the SEAL teams, where you'd have a SEAL platoon and you got a platoon chief, and the platoon chief, those are his guys. And
right.
How does he refer to him? He says, my guys. And he'll get a bad apple in that the guy just is incompetent. He can't do his job. And the platoon chief is, hey, that's my guy. I'm going to get him up to speed. I'm going to take care of him. And he's loyal to him, and he does his best to bring that kid up to speed, and doesn't see that kid is actually putting everyone else in jeopardy.
Right.
So what do you have to do? You have to break out the chief and say, chief, man, I love the fact that you're trying to take care of this guy, but you're actually putting everyone else at risk, and your loyalty to this one guy, you're allowing your loyalty to this one guy trump your loyalty to your platoon. And you got to look at this. You got to step back and have a look at it with me. Look at what this guy's had. 4 safety violations. He's confused in the house. Come up on the rafters and watch this guy on a run. He doesn't belong here. And so that's, you see that in the civilian sector too. So the idea that there's some problem that can happen below you in the chain of command and it's not your fault, it's like, doesn't exist. Doesn't exist. I was talking, I went through this conversation. Like, you plan a mission and you're going to go assault a target and you're going to take helos to the target and you're going to take the target down. You're going to do it, right? Bad weather rolls in and the helos can't come and pick you up, right? Hey, you can easily say, hey, I whatever you want to say about ownership, Jocko, I cannot control the weather.
Right.
Like, it doesn't happen. So we didn't fail the mission. We just couldn't execute it because the weather was bad. And it's like, okay, if that's your attitude, well, then you're never going to change anything. If, on the other hand, you were like, okay, guess what? The weather was bad, and I, as the leader, should have thought about this and had some contingency plans in place that would allow us to execute the mission easier. Anyways, like,
right,
what if we would have forward staged a closer base that we could have actually either taken vehicles or foot patrolled to? Or what if, you know, there's a bunch of different ways to skin this cat that I could have thought about, and maybe those wouldn't be viable. But at least you would say, hey, look, we couldn't take the helicopters. We were forward staged, but there was a report of, you know, massive IEDs on the roads going in, and that's why we foot patrolled. And it's like, okay, now the timeline ran out. Well, okay, guess what? Our last contingency is we're going to roll 24 hours. We've got everything set up, and we'll hit the target the next night. That's okay. Like, but you have to think through this stuff. You have to take ownership of as much as you possibly can. And by the way, are there some things that you absolutely cannot control? Yes, there are. And what do? You mitigate those risks as much as possible, and then you don't worry about them anymore because you can't control them.
So you get to this point. You've counseled, you've recounseled, you've got this guy that you've invested a ton of energy in. You can't have these conversations. You're going to termination mode. You know, you got to terminate.
Mm-hmm.
Advice on termination.
Well, one thing is, when you've already laid out what the expectations are and what the consequences are, when they come into your office, they already know.
Yeah.
That's another thing. These hard conversations, They you soften by doing the right procedure, by escalating correctly. You soften. The final hard conversation isn't even that hard. They come into I've had guys apologize to me, like, I'm so sorry that you have to do this, and they mean it. Like, they feel bad that they couldn't make it happen. And so if you do this correctly, then that final hard conversation is like, look, man, here's what happened. We know that you didn't get done what you're supposed to do, and the best thing I can do for you is I'm going to write you an awesome resume. I'm going to talk to anybody that wants to call me and let them know that you're a really hard worker, but that you didn't work out here because it wasn't the right job for you.
Right.
But I'm going to take care of you, and that's the best I can do, because you know me, man. What I want to do is I want to take care of everyone. I want to take care of this team, and I want to take care of the mission. And right now, as you've seen from the numbers I showed you, from the path that we went down, you're not helping the team right now, and I'm responsible for everyone on the team, bro, not just you. And if you can go away and you come back and you want to reapply and maybe you take another crack at this thing,
right,
come and get it, man. You know, you worked hard. That's the way it is. Every time, here's one more thing to think about. If you care about the guys on your team and you don't have those hard conversations with them, that's actually the worst possible thing you can do. If you don't tell someone where their shortfalls are, how are they ever going to correct those shortfalls?
Right.
And again, if you can work on your tactical eloquence, there, I just made up a new buzzword. If you can work on your tactical eloquence so that you can have conversations with people that don't offend them and that don't feel uncomfortable for you, because you can say, hey, man, you know, like I said, hey, man, bro, I get that you're from Tennessee, but you can't stand up in front of your platoon giving a brief with your CO in the back of the room, spitting every three sentences.
Into a disgusting water bottle.
Into a nasty water bottle. Like, bro, you can't do that. You know, like, that's not a hard conversation to have. It's fun.
Right.
I'm getting the point across. And like I said, sometimes it needs to escalate beyond that. But if you carry yourself correctly, 99% of the conversations I had was that one right there, and it pulled people back on track. Because they know I'm just being a straight shooter. Mm-hmm. I'm not being an asshole. And just telling them what's up in a nice way. And so if you can develop some tactical eloquence, you can become a much better leader just by learning how to communicate people in a non-offensive way. And again, no one expects me to say this. They expect me to be like, no, when someone's out of line, you sit them down,
hammer them,
and you drop the hammer, yeah. The hammer of doom. Right. That's what I do. That's what Jocko rolls.
Yeah.
You know, like Leif, you know, like Leif who wrote the book with me, you know, he'll ask a crowd, you know, when someone's having conversations like this, and he'll ask a crowd, he's like, how many times do you think Jocko yelled at me when I worked for him directly for 18 months? And you know, people will kind of look puzzled, but the answer is zero. Like,
right.
Never. And he says something like, how many times do you think Jocko wanted to yell at me? Because I was a dumb, young lieutenant that didn't know what I was doing. And people are like laughing because, you know, clearly when you're in your second platoon and you're a platoon commander, you're going to make some pretty grievous mistakes because it's a hard job and there's a lot of stuff to learn.
You don't know anything.
And you don't know anything. And, you know, like Leif, he had come from the fleet and he had done one deployment as a SEAL. And so, like, guess what? He had a lot to learn. And, you know, he made a lot of mistakes. We all did when we were young.
Right.
And, you know, I never yelled at him and never had to, you know. But I would say, like, hey, man, you need to take another look at this plan because right now all your eggs, and by all of them, I mean all of them, you got all your eggs in one basket. And if this doesn't go the way you want it to, it's going to be a failure. So
nice.
You just need to, like, think about that.
Right.
And you know, because I didn't say this is a stupid plan.
Right.
Right. I would just ask him to think about the plan a little bit. And asking questions goes a long way. This is another story that Leif talks about. We were doing runs in the kill house, and it was his platoon, and I was in the rafters watching his platoon, and he was in the back of the train. And, you know, I don't believe that in the back of the train you can control anything that's happening. Now, should you be in the front of the train as the assault force commander? Absolutely not, because then you're going to be entering rooms and shooting at targets and handling prisoners, and that takes you out of your job. If you're in the very back of the train, you don't have any idea what's going on in the front of the train, so where do you want to position yourself? Somewhere where you can have some sense of what's going on up front. And I knew that, right?
Right.
And so I just said to him, hey, man, why are you in the back of the train? And I didn't mean it. I didn't say it like this. What the hell are you doing in the back of the train?
Right.
Because that's a different question. That question assumes that he's dumber than me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it assumes. It assumes that I know everything and he knows nothing. But the question, hey, man, what are you doing in the back of the train? That question assumes that he may actually know something that I don't know, which is entirely possible. I don't care how new you are. You can figure something out. So having the attitude of, like, assuming that the other person actually might have knowledge instead of assuming that the other person is an idiot and you're brilliant, that alone goes a long way in your tactical eloquence.
Right.
Something to use.
So we're coming up on the end of this. I want to be as respectful as we can with time. A couple scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You're 6 months out from ETSing out of the military. You don't have a college degree and you want to start a business. How do you prepare for this?
The first thing you got to make sure is that you have your income taken care of, right? Because I'm assuming if you're getting out, you probably have some kind of a family scenario going on, because otherwise, why would you get out?
Right.
Everyone only gets out. Well, most people only get out because they've left their wife and kids behind for months and months and years on end. So you got to figure out how you're going to pay your bills. And that's a weird thing. I think you and I were talking about this yesterday. When you're in the military and you get a paycheck every 2 weeks, and when you're in the military your whole life, you just think that's normal.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big shockers that people have when they get out of the military is the 15th of the month comes around and there's nothing that goes into their account.
Right.
And that's a little bit of a shocker for people. So the first thing you got to do, and you do this before, you know, you do this while you still are in, you save up enough money so that you can survive, so that you can take care of your family. And you got to likely find some avenue of income that's going to allow your family and yourself to be taken care of, to have shelter, food, water, and whatever else you need to survive, right? And then, you know, then you've got whatever this plan, whatever this idea that you have is. And if you're going to start a business, you know, you have your security of whatever that thing is, that whatever that main job is, and then you start building on this idea that you have and check out the viability for it. Some people have really good ideas, they're bad at execution. Some people are good at execution, they have bad ideas. Some people I mean, there's some ideas that aren't good, right? You think it's a good idea, and that's fine. And you, in your own mind, it's brilliant. And as you start talking to people about it, you can't believe how stupid everyone else is that they can't see the brilliance of your idea. And that's very problematic. If there's a point in time where you feel like you have to force your idea into people's lives, it's probably not the best idea. So again, you've got to find your stable income, where that's going to come from, what it's going to be, and then you start developing your business plan. And I definitely like the idea of starting small. You know, keep as much as you can. Don't take money from a bunch of different people where you don't have the ownership that you want. You start small and you build as you need it. You grow as you need it. And at some point, you know, you may have to take some money because you need that capital to kick things off. But just slowly build. Again, this is the dichotomy of leadership, right? This is, you got to take some risks. You're going to risk some money. You're going to risk some time and effort and investment. If you risk too much, then guess what? If you risk too much, you look up in 6 months, the idea didn't go the way you want it to. Now you have to take another job. And now you don't have time to do this idea anymore.
Right.
So you have to remain balanced as you're doing it. And yeah, and the other thing is, you're going to work hard. You're going to work hard at whatever that civilian job is or whatever that other job is that's bringing you money. Every other minute of the day is going to be spent doing this thing that you're trying to bring to life. And every problem that occurs is on you. Every person that has a complaint is calling you. Every vendor that doesn't show up is your responsibility and you have to deal with it. So just be prepared to work 24 hours a day. Because when you have your own business, you work 24 hours a day, and that's the way it is. And it stays like that for a long time until your company gets big enough where some other people can come in and start taking care of stuff for you.
Man, I can't thank you enough. Where can people find you? You just released a new book. Talk to us about where they can find you and what books are out on Amazon and where they should go to actually buy these things.
Okay, so... yeah, I've written a few books. I've written three books for adults. The first one is called Extreme Ownership. That one's about these fundamental leadership principles from combat that I talked about today. And the next book that I wrote was called Discipline Equals Freedom Field Manual, which is really focused not on being a leader of other people. It's basically about leading yourself and how implementing discipline in your life is going to give you the freedom that you want, right? This is what we just talked about with business.
Right.
It's going to take discipline to get this thing launched. Eventually, it's going to give you the freedom that you want, but you have to put the discipline in up front. Same thing with being in good physical health, right? Like, you want to have the freedom to move around and be able to do what you want to do. You have to have the discipline up front to eat correctly and work out. You want to have financial freedom, same thing. Like, you got to have financial discipline in order to end up with financial freedom. And so that book, I also have... people would always ask me what my workouts were, so I put the second half of that book is actually about actions. The first part is thoughts, and the second part is actions. The actions talks about training martial arts, about training shooting, about various workouts to do, recovery, all that kind of stuff, sleep. So that's in Discipline Equals Freedom Field Manual. The last adult book that just came out is called The Dichotomy of Leadership, and I've mentioned what that concept is a bunch of times today, so I don't need to rehash it here. I've written three kids' books. So far, the first one is called Way of the Warrior Kid, and it is about a young kid that has the problems that kids have, which is he can't do any pull-ups, so he gets made fun of. He doesn't know his times table, so he thinks he's stupid. He doesn't know how to swim, so he can't do any of the field trips with the class, and he's getting picked on by a big bully named Kenny Williamson. And he's all sad at the end of the school year, fifth grade. He's all crying behind the library, and he comes home. And he remembers that his Uncle Jake is coming to stay with him for the summer. His Uncle Jake was in the SEAL teams. And he's getting ready to go to college. He's just left the SEAL teams. And so his Uncle Jake shows up. And he's like, hey, what do you want to do tomorrow? You know, you want to go play basketball? You want to go for a swim? What do you want to do? And he's like, well, I can't. Really not good at sports. And I don't know how to swim. And he starts crying and tells him all his problems. And Uncle Jake says, hey, you know what? These are all problems that we can fix. These are all problems we can fix. So he teaches him how to swim. Brings him down. Starts teaching him jiu-jitsu at the jiu-jitsu academy. Teaches him how to study, because he didn't know how to study. He teaches him how to use flashcards and how to memorize things. And teaches him how to work out so he can eventually do pull-ups. So that's Way of the Warrior Kid. The next book after that is the same series. It's called Mark's Mission. And it, the other problems that kids have, learning about work ethic,
right,
learning about discipline, learning how to deal with not physical bullies, but psychological bullies, and why people act that way, and starting to understand human nature a little bit better as a kid. And then I've got another book coming out in November, which is called Mikey and the Dragons, which is a little bit younger age group, and that's about a little kid that scared of everything, and he finds a book about a kingdom where the prince, where the king has died, and the prince needs to step up and defend the kingdom from the dragons, and he's not quite sure he can do it. Finds a note from his dad in the war chest, and it kind of explains him how to stand up and face his fears and face the dragons, and then he's able to do it, and the other kid learns from that book. So those are my books as of right now. You can get them on wherever you buy books.
Right.
They're available. Yeah. I got, as far as finding me, I got a podcast,
yeah,
which is called Jocko Podcast, and what we talk about is, what we're essentially talking about is human nature,
right,
but it's human nature as viewed through the lens of war and atrocity and leadership. Because in my opinion, if you want to get to see human nature in its clearest form, it doesn't become any more revealed than in times of high stress on people's lives, which is combat and atrocities. So that's Jocko Podcast, and you can listen to
right,
wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm on the big social media. Yeah, that's just Jocko Willink, right, at Jocko Willink on all the different variety of things.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for being on the show. I said that several times. I have all your books. I share all your books. I've talked about them within my company. I've talked about them within other guys and other companies. I share your podcasts. Huge amount of respect for what you do. It's been an honor and a privilege for me to just sit here for an hour and 20 minutes. Man, it's awesome. So
yeah, well, I appreciate it. I don't know if I'm all that, but same back at you, man. I mean, you got out and you've been running your thing, and you guys are getting after, and it's awesome to see. You guys are great examples of what vets are capable of, and it's everything I just talked about. You guys took your leadership principles, and turned them into kick-ass businesses, multiple businesses, which is an amazing thing to see, and I like seeing it. And so, back at you, respect.
Awesome. Well, I'm Evan Hafer with Launch Code and Drinking Bros. Thanks a lot, guys, and stay tuned for our next one.